Nerds Netter, just talking to teachers.
Talking to teachers about academic research and evidence-based practice with continuing professional development at PNA 1977 on Twitter.
Nerds Netter, just talking to teachers.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to this episode of Nailers Natter with me, Emma Turner, where I'm going to be start again, I can't even speak.
Put the teeth back in, Emma.
What's introducing instead of interviewing? Right, start again. Hello, everybody, and welcome to this episode of Nailers Natter with me, Emma Turner, where I'll be interviewing the absolutely wonderful and wise Roz Wilson. Welcome, Roz.
Oh, is that me? Thank you. I'm going to shut the curtains. Hi, Emma. How are you? You're looking stunning. Is that a Rolling Stones t-shirt?
It's a Rolling Stones sweatshirt. Yes, I am channeling my inner rock chick today.
Oh, and what's on the lower half to go with that?
On the lower half are a pair of leather leggings, Ross.
Oh, my God, leather leggings. You are joking, Emma.
Nope, look, there you go. Rolling Stones, whilst homeschooling and interviewing you, I am literally living the rock and roll lifestyle today.
I just think it's because they're waterproof and we all have difficulty waiting that long when we're doing these interviews.
My waterproof trousers. Yeah, so we are recording from live from Turner Towers, and I am homeschooling at the moment with my eldest who's self-isolating. So apologies to listeners and to Phil for editing if we have a little person kind of drift in to ask me about their homework. I do apologize in advance.
Oh, Emma, how old is the child that's homeschooling?
She's 9. Her bubble popped the other day, so she's homeschooling with mummy, which is interesting logistics at the moment.
Do you know, it's not funny, but my granddaughter is 10 and her bubble popped this week too. She's having until the 19th, they are being homeschooled. But for her, it's a much better experience than it was first time round, Emma, because the teacher has to be at home too, because of course she was there in the classroom when the child who has tested positive and is ill became ill. So she's teaching them from home. She's doing the teaching on the home school instead of just sending sometimes ridiculous work for parents who aren't experienced in those subjects as we do them now to teach at home. And that's a formidable process.
Oh, it's the amount of work that teachers are putting in at the moment is absolutely unreal.
Yes.
The way that everybody's responded to the digital platforms, to being able to work remotely, teach remotely, some teachers are juggling teaching live in school and providing remote learning as well for certain classes. It's absolutely unbelievable the amount of work and how agile teachers have been in responding to this. But I'm not going to lie, even though I'm a teacher myself, homeschooling and balancing working from home with homeschooling, and yet to find the sweet spot and actually get it right, because it's really hard.
Do you know, Emma, last time that was such a long, how long did we go with that teaching at home stuff?
She said 47 years, 47 years.
It was horrendous, and even the best of children were stressed by the end of it. It's not healthy to live in the room that becomes your classroom, the parents who become your teachers, you know, on the days when you feel down, there's no one else to lift you up, is there? Friends to laugh with or run with.
It was so nice to connect with so many people online, though, that were in the same boat. And the kids were obviously able to speak to friends and family via Zoom. But it's not the same as being in the same room with all your mates or all your family. And
of course not.
And I cannot wait for the day where we all kind of can be in the same room together again as a family, as, you know, as friends, as colleagues. That's what I'm clinging on to. It will happen. We will get there. But in the interim, my goodness me, we are having to respond to some challenges.
Now we've cheered ourselves up.
Yeah. can't even wipe my nose on anything because I've got leather trousers.
No, but you are right about our profession. They've come a million miles in this and they've coped with it relentlessly. found ways of doing it. And in the main, for the children's sake, in front of the children, they've kept cheerful and positive and enthusiastic, and they are incredible.
Yeah, absolutely incredible. Hats off to everybody in the profession, the support staff, the office staff, the admin, the cleaners, the premises officer, the governors, everybody who's involved in education. Absolutely unbelievable effort. Absolutely brilliant. Right. Let's put COVID to bed for a moment, Ross.
Is this a problem I need to know about? And is it catching back?
I've just scratched my head. No, this is my thinking. This is my thinking thing.
Oh, is it? I wondered if fleas got COVID. That was all I was wondering, you know.
Not got fleas. They can't stick to me in these leather trousers, Ross.
No, but they make you sweat.
I'm hot now.
Just kind of surprised.
Right, let's move on to you and your career then. So for people who haven't been familiar with your career, which spans multiple decades, multiple areas across the globe, do you want to give us a little quick précis of all these things that I've done kind of thing, Roz? What's been your career story?
Oh, my goodness. Have you got a cup of coffee there?
No, I need to say the word précis here.
You can't précis 56 years.
What do you have in the book, in the sleeve of your book?
Can I read it?
I just read that, shouldn't I?
Make sure the two stories fit in case I move things around a bit. I started teaching in 1965. I was a three-year trained teacher in the days when there were dedicated teacher training colleges. But it is right to say that my first year in college, that third year that we're leaving at that end of that year, were the first three-year trained teachers. Before that, teachers only had 2 years of training. So imagine what it was like for them going in. Mind you, children used to behave in those days, so didn't do anything else, you know. So I left college and I didn't do anything about getting a job. I didn't want to be a teacher. I hated teachers. I'd hated school. I only went to college to get out of school because I discovered you could go to teacher college at the end of first year sixth if you had a September birthday, which I did. So it was a way out of doing full sixth form. I tried to escape in the fifth form and the head teacher had told me that if I did, she'd tell the truth about me. I stayed on because, you know, they're always wanting to build a sixth form, aren't they? Anyway, long short, I went to Bretton Hall, which was a very beautiful college dedicated in those days to art, music and PE, full of wonderful, talented people, many of whom are very well known today in their own fields. The only thing I didn't do, no one had ever told me that it was important to research the locality of the college. I found the nearest pub was 3 miles away and no buses, so you had to walk for 3 miles to get a drink. You had to be a very dedicated drinker to do that, Emma. But we managed it. We managed it very well. And then suddenly I discovered 2 weeks before it was time for me to leave college that everyone in my year had gone out and got a job and I hadn't. And I only discovered that because the head of education asked me where I was going to teach. And the idea had never occurred to me. I never thought I'd have to go and teach. In fact, I thought I was there forever, you know, just wandering along to the pub every day and back. Anyway, he organised me, he got the TES out, he rang a school, he decided which school it would be, and lo and behold, I turned up at Normanton Secondary Modern on September the 5th, I think it was, 1965. And that's another story. No time for that one now, or it'll take me the whole day. I spent 4 years there. There's a funny blur in my memory about what happened with the timings here. I think I left in the middle of the year, academic year. I think that's what explains the confusion. I did 3 years as a pure art teacher because I'd trained as an art teacher, but I got very bored with it. I didn't like students coming and going all day. I wanted to have a relationship with the student, not with the subject, if you see what I mean. I wanted to know more about them. I wanted to teach my register class, who I loved. So I went into special needs at that school, and then I fell off my motor scooter. So I saw there was a job down in the same village I lived in, and I moved there. So I became primary and did special needs there, which I loved. But in the meantime, we'd applied to go overseas. And so in 1970, my ex-husband and I went off to the Bahamas. And we had 5 years in the Bahamas, and then we had more years in the Cayman Islands. I was around the Caribbean for 17 years before I left the ex-husband and brought the two children, aged 13 and 11, back to England. And I had to start right back at the beginning again, and it was hard, Emma, and it was an awful shock. And once again, I started back in secondary after all these years in primary. At a secondary school out just on the edge of Leeds, and that was horrendous, and I was there a whole term. And then I got a permanent job at a middle school in Bradford, which I loved, head of English. I was teaching maths and science in the secondary school, absolutely ridiculous. And you know, there's nothing mathematical or scientific about me at all. And then I taught middle school for 5 years, and then I moved to Kirklees purely to be nearer to home, because my kids were now middle teens and getting out of control because I was late home every night. But ended up in a school I adored called Chickenley. Mm-hmm. Challenging school, challenging children, traumatic lives, love them to pieces. And then I was asked to apply for the job of assessment advisor, because I did know a lot about assessment. I already did when I came back from overseas. And I had seven wonderful years as assessment advisor in Kirklees. And then I went off to Qatar, and that fantastic time starting that huge school with my friend and former colleague, dear friend, Mick Farley. He'd got the principal's job, and we started up the primary, and I ran the primary while he ran around trying to get the secondary. And we were doing all this in blocks of flats. We hadn't even got a school building. And then I came back to England in January 2000, when we'd had an Ofsted, an HMI out, and she'd said the school was outstanding. So I thought, I'm going to get trapped here as head teacher. And that wasn't my aim. I was 56. If I'm going to start again, I need to go back home. So I started the consultancy, and I had a list of about 16 things I could offer to schools, you know, pre and post Ofsted, because I was an Ofsted inspector, and behaviour management, and EAL, and Ascend, and I don't know, everything in the world. Now, the little last line said, oh, and I know something about writing, because I'd already started the big writing then, you know. And that was what just took off, and it blocked everything else out, because people were desperate in the year 2000 for help with how to improve standards in writing, because writing was stubbornly remaining low. So from 2000 until about 3 years ago, 4 years ago, I was doing nothing but big writing, so working a lot alone. And the thing that changed for me was in 2014, when we got the new curriculum and the levels went. And there was a wonderful little run of things which Dame Alice and Peacock, Professor Sam Twistleton, and all the many wonderful friends I've got today were doing the No More Levels run of courses around the country, Beyond Levels, with Julie Lilly managing us and trying to keep us in line. It was a wonderful time.
Oh gosh, she was got a job on her hands.
I know, and that's when I expanded in many, many ways, and started talking about far wider things than just writing, because of course I'd been a teacher for so many years and an advisor and all that. I knew an awful lot more than just big writing, but I hadn't been had time to talk about it. So this last few years, I've gradually been inching, I say, towards retirement, but I seem to be spending retirement all day at my desk on my laptop writing. So I don't know what that's about. But I'm not travelling. Well, I can't travel. No one can travel. But I'm already decided that I'm not travelling as much and as many nights in hotels. That's hard work.
Oh.
Someone knocking at my door. Am I supposed to answer it, Emma?
You can go and answer it and we can stop this.
Can you stop it a minute? Yeah,
right, we're back. Ross has answered the door. So to a mystery caller.
I didn't answer it, I just shouted hello, like old people do, you know. Nobody shouted back, so I've left them to it.
Oh, bless you.
I think we just about finished the story anyway.
We had. And I think it's so bizarre. It's so odd for me because I remember around about 2000, I was, how many years I've been teaching then? A couple of years. And I remember sitting in my classroom with a spreadsheet with your name on the top of it, assessing my writing. And I remember thinking, wonder what this Ros Wilson's like who's done all of this. And I remember sitting there with a pile of literacy books and your spreadsheet.
Cursing me.
Pardon? No.
Cursing me.
No, not at all. Not at all. Thinking, thank God someone's unravelled this for me.
The assessment process worked because it is truly formative and diagnostic as well as giving a summative score.
Yeah.
No, there's a lot of people who believe you can't have one assessment system that does do all that. But I actually, the assessment system for big writing does do all that.
Well, our writing results went through the roof for us, so you were doing something right.
Thank you.
Right, so we've mentioned that you have worked globally and you've worked across the sector, you've worked in every age group, you've worked in multiple countries, you know, at every sort of level, from leadership to strategy to national to classroom. So with your kind of global hat on, with all this international experience, what do you think we as a profession can learn from a global perspective? What are the things that we need to take from what's happening internationally?
I think that's a huge question, Emma.
I like to start with a big one.
I think the answer can come in at different levels, can't it? Because as a British person, I'm immensely proud of our education systems in our four countries, which are very similar and the strengths are very similar. There are differences in curriculum, etc., obviously. But the principles behind it are almost identical. And I think our principles are excellent, you know, and are balanced between the curriculum and the pastoral and getting it right for children and trying to make education exciting and interesting and challenging and motivating. And I think that in quite a number of the countries I've visited, and I have visited almost every corner of the planet in my role as a consultant over the 20 years, that isn't the same principles at all. Even in some of our friends on the continent, in their education systems, teachers very fiercely don't see themselves as having any pastoral role at all. Their job is to teach their subject and it's up to the children to get on board or not as they see fit. I've met many, many wonderful teachers and very strong bonds. As you travel overseas and work in overseas schools, you realise that you meet certain types of teachers everywhere. And for example, from different parts of the communities at home, wherever you teach overseas, you seem to meet the Welsh, the Scottish and the Yorkshire. Now, I don't know what that says about the three of us as groups. Of course, we in Yorkshire know that Yorkshire is the largest county and it's big enough to be a country in its own right, and one of these days we might just rise up and create a kingdom.
Didn't Yorkshire, if you took them as just a group in the last Olympics, rank really highly just as Yorkshire for medals?
Yes, we beat many. We did. But you see, we're God's own county. How could we fail? God's own country, even. So we know he created Yorkshire first, and then the rest of the world grew out of it. So just don't teach that in schools, because some cultures will struggle with that concept.
The concept of Yorkshire as the birthplace of humanity.
Yes, the world began in Yorkshire. It would be interesting, but mainly it's the southerners of England that wouldn't cope with that.
I'm a Midlander. I'm constantly on the fence. I'm
not there. You go. You're living half in a cave and half in a mansion.
Yeah.
We in the caves know what it's all about, you know.
Brilliant. So you've
have I answered the question? I've forgotten.
Well, we've been all over the world. We've said pastoral systems. We can learn a lot from.
Yes.
And then basically, there ain't no place like home. Was the gist of that one, I think.
I know that there ain't no teachers like.
Okay. Some
of the Australian and some of the American and some quite a lot of the Canadian teachers that I worked with were huge fun, and I mean I absolutely adored the West Indian teachers, and it felt sad for some of the teachers that I met from other parts of the world, particularly the Middle East and the parts of the Far East, because they hadn't been allowed the freedoms that we'd been allowed. So they hadn't developed that confidence and that principle that you could go off piste and you could make learning fun and you could enrich it for children and you could empower children and trust children. And those principles didn't exist in many of the state schools. They did in the independent schools. The independent schools overseas are magnificent because they're run very much on the principles of the best of England and Britain, which is what you can do if you're running your own schools overseas, isn't it?
Yeah. Because you talk a lot about your work overseas in one of your books. It's Just a Journey, which I read. Which I journeyed with you through lockdown with. That was one of my lockdown reads when we had that lovely period of good weather. And I read it in the garden, in the sunshine, but then it did get very splashed by the children in the paddling. Yeah, there you go. Roz is waving a copy of it at me. But mine fell to bits because my children splashed it so much with the paddling pool that it's now in pieces. So mine doesn't look
as good. Your excuse. That's your excuse.
But I loved it. I loved it. And if you haven't read...
It was spilling the gin and tonic that did it.
The lockdown gin. Yeah. If you haven't read It's Just a Journey, please do. It's absolutely fascinating and gives those global, international perspectives of Roz's experience, which are so warm, so heartening, and just so joyful to read and to contrast the changes in education through the last few decades and also how education is structured abroad. It's absolutely fascinating. But we're going to talk a little bit more about your new book, It Takes 5 Years to Become a Teacher, which was published recently. And you did a lovely launch event on Twitter recently. Is that uploaded anywhere, Roz? Do you know if that's uploaded for anybody to watch, that launch?
Yes, it's on YouTube.
Oh, fantastic. I'm sure Phil...
And it's on my website, which is Roz...
RozWilsonEd.com?
Yeah. Yeah.
There you go.
Thank you. All thanks to Richard Robinson, our mutual friend.
The man with the tech. So it's called It Takes 5 Years to Become a Teacher. So why 5 years, Ross? Why five?
You know, Emma, I can't honestly remember whether I made that line up or whether I heard someone else say it and reflected on it and absorbed it. I can remember very well that after 3 years, I thought I'd become a teacher. But the teacher I was after 5 years was a different teacher from the one I was at 3 years. The one at 3 years was very different from the starting out one. I don't know if that's making sense.
No, it is. It is. And lots of people will have read...
Sorry.
Lots of people have read things about novices and experts and the difference between a novice teacher, an expert teacher, or a novice and expert in any subject. But it's, this is the real life version of that. It's not just a theoretical bit. This is the kind of pulling out and teasing out of actually, yeah, something does happen during your...
There's a magic. Days. And that's what Kirsty said to me that day over a Chinese meal when she and her husband, Ben, she'd been my front of house. She's got a whole chapter in this book. And she'd been my front of house when I was a consultant racing all over the country and all around the world. And so we spent many hours together on aeroplanes, in cars, in hotels. And we'd talk about anything and everything. And I'd been talking to a large group of teachers, and I'd just used it as a throwaway remark and said, well, of course, it takes 5 years to become a teacher. And Kirsty had asked me about that at dinner that night because she wanted to be a teacher and she had a degree, but she hadn't done a PGCE yet. And I explained to her that, you know, you have a sort of surface competency after 3 years. You can do the job, you can manage your classes most of the time, you know your subjects, hopefully. But now is the time to grow. You need to keep learning and you need to keep digging into your subjects. The more subject knowledge you've got, the more you can be creative and respond to the children, to their questions, to their... They're always, you know, you're always having to put them off because you don't actually know the answer when they ask a question that's off-piste, like, why did he always wear that, you know, or what did you say that for, when you're talking about royalty or explorers or whatever, real people in the world, or scientists, whatever they might be. So the more your knowledge expands and the more you're prepared to go and sit on the front of your desk and just chat to the class sometimes in between doing the real teaching, the more you realise that you've got this, and that's when you can become inspirational. You get to the point where I compare it to conducting an orchestra, and anyone who knows me knows I don't know two notes of music, but you know how you watch the conductor and they can sweep them up into a frenzy and then they can calm them right down. I've no idea if I'm doing the right thing.
It looks very good, Ross.
It convinced me too, Emma, so we're happy, who cares. And that's what being a real experienced teacher is like. You can whip your classes up into frenzies of excitement and discussion and motivation, and you can calm them right down into moments of quiet reflection and production. Excuse me, I'm
it reminds me as well a little bit about parenting, like with your first baby, you're just kind of like flying by the seat of your pants most of the time, wondering what the hell you're going to do, how you're getting to eat, to sleep, to do, how to get out of the house. By the time I'd had my third, they were very close together, my three-way, but by the time I had my third, I was like, yeah, I can do this, no problem at all. And it's that kind of quiet confidence that comes with, I've done this before, I've thought about how to do it, I know how to do it, I can kind of do it without thinking now, so actually I can enjoy it a lot more and I can be more of myself and be more proactive in what I'm doing rather than reacting to the situation that's in front of me.
That's right, and being able to trust the children and let them go, because you have the knowledge to know where they're going, to be able to listen and watch and steer them slightly if they're going on a non-useful path, but let them stay in control. But just imagine, Emma, how much better you'd have done the job if you'd had 5 children.
That's my worst nightmare.
Or even 10.
I have nightmares about having another one. I can't do it again. I remember number 3 is a delight. He's the apple of my eye. But I do remember finding out that we were expecting him and crying. And Tom was like, why are you crying? I said, I can't do weaning again. I can't do it. Anyway, I digress. So we've got this book, The 5 Years to Become a Teacher. What do you want the book to do, Roz, for people?
I think the big thing was, it goes back to that Chinese meal with Kirsty and Ben. The big thing was we were sympathizing, empathizing, more than that. Make those words as strong as you can, because I can't say how much we were feeling for the young teachers who were starting out this last September, 2 months ago. I wonder how they are. Big hugs for them. After such a disruptive final year of education. And we were saying, you know, that first year of teaching is so hard anyway, as is the second and the third in many cases, without having had the disruption that they've had. So they've not properly finished college in the way you would have liked them to be able to, or even their final teaching experiences. So when we were chatting about that, we were saying, wouldn't it be lovely to put our arms around them and tell them that it's going to be all right. And when you're struggling, we all struggled. And this is a long job, but it's worth it, because it does take 5 years to become a teacher. But what a rich and rewarding and exciting and everything-ing job it is once you get there. And that was the moment at which I said, I know what we should do. We should write a book. And so it was born. And I wrote to just a very small number of colleagues who became the co-authors and said, I did that straight away, because this conversation was only something like July. And bless them, I thought only two or three would, but they all said yes. That was Dame Alison Peacock, Professor Sam Twistleton, their names are on the cover of the book, Rachel Coburn, Chris Dyson, Dr. Emma Kell, Sarah Mullin, and Halil Tamgumas. And they're all there on the cover as co-authors, and then Kirsty, who did a full chapter, and it's a large chapter in her own right, because she's just finished that five-year journey. And every one of them came back, and they wrote so quickly, and they sent it so quickly. And you know, when it started to come, I meanwhile started to write the main book. But when their contributions came back, Emma, I was stunned to see, every story was different, obviously. They were writing about how it was for them at the very start of their career. They were all very, very different, but there were strong threads running through. There were strong similarities, particularly to do with the challenges for most of us in the beginnings of our careers. And that struck me, because you tend to think, I'm the only person who struggled. You tend to keep it quiet. You know, you look at the other confident teachers around you, and when you're reflecting on it, you're thinking, well, why am I finding it so hard? But the reality is that they all found it that hard, you know? Why did our lecturers at college never tell us how hard it was in the beginning? Why did not one of them ever sit on the front of their desk and anecdotally tell about what it's like to start out as a teacher? And why didn't your colleagues in the school you started at, not one of them, not one ever, when they actually started talking to me, which took a very long time, they never told me about their early experiences as teachers. And so that's what this book was about. It was about, it's okay to have a bad day. It's okay to have a lesson that you know wasn't that satisfactory, because tomorrow's another day. You put your head back up, you put your shoulders down, you put a smile on your face, and you sail back in again. This book is supposed to give them the big hug that we can't actually give them physically. And so it's not written like an academic research project. It's written as a really informal but informed story about how it is in the first 5 years until you become a teacher. And that was when these wonderful people sent their contributions back, suddenly thought, well, if it's like that for eight of us, is it like that for everybody? So that was when I just tweeted on Twitter and said, is there anyone out there in the ether who'd be willing to write about the start of their career? And another 17 wonderful people sent their contributions in. And so there's actually, 26, 27, I can't do the maths, of us all giving similar but different messages about the start of our careers.
And it jumps off the page as well, Roz. I think I said in your the launch thing that it's like, for an early career teacher, this book, knocking on the door, a bit like your mystery caller, but having the door opened and being welcomed into some great big kind of party, or, you know, sit around the dinner table and saying, you know, we're all here. Welcome. Come and join us. We'll tell you all about it, warts and all. And we all made a right hash of it to start off with, but we're all here now, we're all still standing. And, you know, it's a bit like when you were talking then, it reminded me of, nobody ever tells a pregnant lady what it's like to actually have a baby.
No, because the population would have died out a million years ago if they did. I certainly wouldn't have done it. Gosh.
Maybe it's the same with that with your NQT year. You know, people are reluctant to tell you the kind of the bad bits, because actually they go so quickly, and the kind of the end product of being a teacher is such a wonderful job to be part of. But we do need to recognise, like you say, that it's tricky in those early years. And especially now, it's really hard. I work with lots of early career teachers on our programmes, and this year it's just bonkers, for want of a better word.
I don't know how they're doing it, Emma. I have the hugest admiration, and I think the whole profession does, and we're thanking them too, because clearly the profession won't survive if they don't survive. So
the ones I work with are absolutely smashing it. Honestly, they're brilliant, absolutely so positive, so focused, so agile, so just dedicated to what they're doing. It's an absolute privilege to work with them, which kind of brings me on to my next question, which is, what do you think is the biggest challenge for an early career teacher? And have these demands on the early career teachers, have the demands put on them changed at all during your career? And if so, how?
They're hugely different, Emma. I think that's the secret. I think, you know, back in the day when I started, and right up until, I don't know, 1990s, there were no mentors. You walked into a school and the support you got was as good as the ethos of the school. And the absolute truth, and that's in Journeys, but the absolute truth is, I got none at all. No, it's in 5 years too, but from a different angle. I got no support at all, no support. And there was a whole culture of, you finished your training, you've got your certificate, you're being paid, just do it. You're supposed to know the job. So you didn't dare ask anyone. You were afraid to admit you'd had a bad lesson, you know? You were afraid to ask for help. And no one ever offered it. Nobody ever. In fact, then people didn't speak to me. They didn't speak to me at all. And I didn't speak to them because I didn't know I could. I felt like, I don't know what I felt like, some kid is kicked in a corner, but I got classes through to 16, 17 years old, coming through the door from an extremely challenging and impoverished community that is a former pit town in West Yorkshire, where I live now. So it was horrendous. Today, things are different because young teachers are mentored, and in the main, the mentors are superb, and they give endless time and patience. Sadly, for some young teachers, that's not true, but for the vast majority, it is. And what they need to accept is that they don't have to just draw on their mentor's expertise. They can ask other teachers as well, particularly when it comes to subject specialisms and displays and stuff like that. But I think their bigger challenges are the curriculum and the lack of vision from the very top in education today. I'm not talking about educationalists. I'm talking about government and the way pendulums swing. They've always swung, don't get me wrong. Every time there's a change of government, there's a change of curriculum and educational ethos, because it's one of the few things they can make their stamp on, because we haven't taken control of our own profession as most other professions have. But right now we've gone through 15, 20 years of continued fluctuation and change of message. And many schools have lost direction. I mean, we're in a ridiculous situation where we both know many schools who are redeveloping their curriculum yet again, even though we had a new national curriculum in 2014, and theoretically this was all done then. There's a big curriculum changes going on. Thank goodness for the best of reasons. But then we'll go and have another government change and it'll all get rattled in again and we'll have to start again. And of course, the challenges are the children, because children these days, particularly in primary school, there's a wonderful new report on vocabulary come out from OUP, a research-based report on vocabulary. And of course, I was advocating the teaching of vocabulary from big writing in the year 2000. So I welcome it, delighted to see it. But it does talk about the fact that children are not going from year 6 into year 7, from primary into secondary, with sufficient vocabulary, particularly of the second and third tiers. And I thought, you have no idea that whoever was behind that bit of the report, that we are getting children into primary schools, into the early years, who can't talk. They grunt and they have single syllables, you know, and half a sentence, but they can't communicate. Mm. And schools are having to compensate for that. And actually the job that the vast majority of primary schools are doing on teaching children to talk is wonderful. But there's many. We've had a lot of press this week because of COVID from Ofsted, wasn't it? About the fact that many, many, many children are losing skills, even like using the toilet properly and like holding a knife and fork to eat, let alone the skills of talk, because they don't get those experiences in their homes today. It's a great deal of it is impoverished homes, but it's not all. Many of it is homes like, I'm not saying you, but like your home, like my daughter's home, where two parents are both working, they're both extremely busy, and children have lost themselves in a world of technology, and we don't, unless we make ourselves, which I know you and my daughter do, but many families don't have time to sit around the dinner table and just chat like they used to do in the old days, and do the don't speak with your mouth full and hold your fork properly and all those things, you know, which are so important for being able to mingle and mix and travel the world and communicate with people all over the place in a way that, good grief, look, I'm going to stop. What was the question?
It's still relevant. It's about challenges for early career teachers. So
that's the product they're working with. But and then, of course, you can't even touch on the additional challenge of COVID. You know, you and I both have young girls who are in burst bubbles at home. How these teachers, well, you know, perhaps they're coping better with it than some of the more mature teachers who've it harder to change how they work. I don't know, but
well, that's an interesting point actually, because when I first started teaching in 98, it was around the times of the national strategies being rolled out, the literacy strategy and the numeracy strategy.
15 2010.
God, don't even start with that one. I'm just gonna say carousel and leave that there. The have to be of a certain age to get that one. But yeah, I remember thinking, with especially with the math strategy, you know, I really like this. This is really helpful. This is good stuff. And I remember adopting it really quickly. And actually, the teachers who were really finding it more challenging were those with it already established practice, because they, you know, they built that up over a number of years. And I ended up going on to work for the National Strategies as a consultant for a while in our local area. And I swear it's because I was a strategy baby, because I basically didn't know anything else. That was all I knew. And so early career teachers adapting well is actually this isn't their new normal for teaching. This is normal for them, because this is what they know, you know. And yeah, this is why they've adapted it to it so quickly, because they've not got the frustration of, oh, I'd really love to do it how I normally do it, you know, or, you know, this doesn't feel right, this doesn't feel natural. Actually, this is what we've got, this is what we're making of it. So it may well be that the teachers who are coming out of this, I don't mean on top, but the teachers who are coming out of it, less affected potentially.
Oh, Emma, I had a big thought. Well, I wasn't thinking at all. It was a big pop into the head, which is how my brain works. Just pops all the time. COVID-19 is terrible. This pandemic, there's many people older than me saying it's almost worse than a war. It is worse than a war, what it's doing to the country and what it's doing to countries all over the world. And it's traumatic and it's terrible. But suddenly there are little lights popping on all over the place. You know, we have a vaccine created in a phenomenal time that has never been achieved before. And nobody thought it could be done until COVID. And we have these whole new ways of teaching and using technology that many of my generation and many of middle year teachers would have perhaps even resisted against. Mm-hmm. Well, I think we did, because it had already been muted that by 2050, all children would be taught electronically. No, you can't beat the human being in the classroom. But perhaps you're not in competition. It's back to Sarah's lovely phrase, isn't it, Sarah Mullen? It's cooperation, not competition. Perhaps there is a place for a mix of the two, and we're going to learn a lot out of the young teachers' responses to the challenges of teaching in COVID.
Yeah, and I do think there's been so much learned, not just in our profession, but everywhere, about what's important to people, what really matters, you know, what really works, what doesn't work. What it's also because we had to stop in lockdown completely, and when we're coming back to school, it's given us a real opportunity as a sector to think, what do we want to come back to? What's important to us in education? What do we really value? What if we've had this kind of pause here, the most manic pause we've ever had, because people haven't, you know, people are working so hard. But actually, we've had to shelve a lot of the things that we did for so many years that were ingrained, that people thought, you can't change that. That's just the way it is. Well, actually, lockdown's flipped everything on its head and said, there's nothing that can't really change. So I think it's about asking ourselves the questions of, what do we want to keep and what do we want to change as a result? Yeah.
Because and one of the biggest lessons that's come out of COVID is that the most crucial thing is human relationships, being able to have human relationships. And that comes back to that beginning of the teaching career. It's relationships that you develop, and the way that we're all asking mature teachers to embrace the new teachers and make them feel it's okay to talk about the things that are difficult for them, and the new teachers to be prepared to stand up in the middle of the staff room and say, I've got no clothes on, you know. That's the emperor. Come on.
No, it's the emperor. It just made me laugh. Well, sorry.
That's why it's like me. I'm suspecting, you see, that you've got no trousers on.
There they are.
So, well, I can't lift my leg that high. I believe that everyone on Zoom is only dressed down to the waist. And
I've just done the school run with the two younger ones. I am actually dressed. So you've taught pretty much everything, every subject,
every age.
Yeah. What's your favourite thing to teach?
Well, I trained for English and art. But the thing that gave me the most pleasure, and this will make a lot of people laugh probably, is teaching PE. I absolutely adored it, and I'm absolutely useless at PE. Really, truly am. I played for the netball team in high school, but I lurked on the wing in the hockey team and hoped it would be foggy so I couldn't be seen. Or I was known to hide in the showers and just not go out at all. I couldn't run, never been a runner, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Couldn't jump, can't do anything. Badly coordinated, still am. Fell out of the chip shop door last week, you all know. I did find, and this is what I'd say to teachers too, that everybody has gifts. And we often don't, many teachers don't find their gifts because gifts are often not the gift of being able to produce a beautiful painting. You know, that's an obvious gift, but the gift of being able to play the violin wonderfully. Those are obvious gifts, but there are many other gifts that can enrich you as a teacher. I mean, I found I had the gift of the gab, the gift of talking, but that's not because I had cultivated it. It's just because I was born gabbing and I've been gabbing ever since, you know. But I did find I had the gift when I was watching athletes or performers or whatever, of being able to analyse what it was they were doing and what made that one more effective than that or what appeared to do. And of translating the performance of often adult athletes and sports people into a language that could be conveyed to pupils, primary school pupils particularly, to coach them to become better athletes. And that gave me immense pleasure and huge fun and satisfaction. And in my years in the Caribbean, when you spent all your days and all your evenings and all your weekends, or we did anyway, working with and for the children. Particularly I ran the swimming team, the primary school swimming team, and we won everything on the board. We won everything at sports day in athletics. And
I love that story you tell in your journey book about the bus when it got stuck as well.
Oh, the mighty beast.
Yeah.
I love that story. Yeah. You know, I don't, well, I won't say what I was just going to say, but I have to give the ex-husband credit for an English-trained English boy in the 1960s, and the 1960s were not as progressive. They were progressive in thought, but they weren't progressive in deed. To actually just say, yeah, I can do that, and get in a blooming great big bus and drive it, on what wasn't a road, it was only a cleared patch, a track through the bush. So it was all sand and potholes and lumps of rock and God knows roots coming through. It was an amazing act of confidence or stupidity, one or the other. But to do it with 60 kids on board and your wife takes a bit of beating too. And yeah, we... long story short, he had to reverse a little bit, reverse down into a hole, bus tipped over backwards, and we ended up like an angle like that. So the kids at the top were 20 feet in the air and the kids at the bottom were halfway down a hole.
Oh my God, I can't imagine today, the risk assessment from the association. Oh,
you'd be fired, wouldn't you? We were all petrified at first, but then there was huge hilarity and we all managed to get off and stand in the bush waiting for help, which came. It's all in the book.
So I mentioned risk assessments and paperwork then, and obviously governance occasionally gets a bad rap for being more about the paperwork than the children, I'm co-chair of governors at my children's school. I'm hoping that I won't just be about paperwork. It will just be more about the kids. But you're a governor at the wonderful Chris Dyson School, aren't you?
I am a new governor, yes. I was inducted only a couple of weeks ago. I had my first Zoom governor meeting. I'm a little nervous, Emma. You know, some things have changed since because I was a governor for nearly 20 years in a primary school in Kirklees. But I know I'll love it. I love Chris Dyson to death. I love Parklands Primary to death. And I know that I'll be much more encouraged to be in touch with the children and other staff than with pieces of paper.
But for people who are in governance already, how do you think governance can support a school? You know, what makes a great governor?
I think having relevant knowledge in the area you're supporting is a huge help. The whole governing body don't have to do, but it helps if the vast majority do. And one of the things they were doing at the meeting we held a couple of weeks ago was talking about the three areas of governance and which people thought they could best contribute to. And, you know, giving reasons why you thought it if you wanted to. But I think in times of crisis like this, you're giving encouragement and warmth and support. It's like quite a few of us have been a little bit cross when we've heard Ofsted's coming into a school. You know, a head teacher who I've worked with since the beginning of her headship almost in the Birmingham area, and the week before half term, in the middle of COVID pandemic, and Ofsted's coming in. I don't care if they can say they're coming in as friends. They're disrupting what's going on in the school at a time when there is far too much going on, and it'll be very difficult for some of the teachers to cope with that disruption. Mm. I don't know how it came out. I haven't asked her. She will come to me if she wants to talk about it. That's the relationship I always have with heads. I don't pester them. I don't ring them up every few weeks. But if they ring me, I'm there. Or if they PM me, I'm there. And I know her, and I know she'll have been outstanding. I think it's the role of anyone who's there in a kind of monitoring capacity, which is what governance is about. It's about ensuring the best for the school. And sadly, very now and again, there are huge things that go wrong in a school. So governance has an important part to play, but not in a time of crisis. It's support and encouragement, being a listening ear, particularly for head teachers. Many head teachers have a very lonely path to furrow, keeping everyone else on board. If they're lucky, they have a really strong friend as a deputy head, and that means that they have much more strength and team working. Am I rambling?
No, not at all. I completely resonates with me, because doing the co-headship with Claire, we were never alone. So I totally get the fact that I can recognise the support that we gave each other in headship. And I often wonder how a lone head manages those demands and, you know, emotional demands.
There's another book in there called It Takes 3 Years to Become a Head Teacher.
There is.
Someone said to me the other week, are you going to write it? Perhaps we ought to start on it, Emma.
Yeah, I'm in. Count me in. Right, I'll do the co-headship bit for you. My last question is, of all the things you've done, what's been your favourite role?
I loved the years in Kirklees. The Kirklees Authority in the 1990s was a leading light in the country. And on the huge team, there were 60 inspectors and advisors. And we met quite a number of times a year as one team, which was very unusual. And the quality of sharing ideas and of talk and the bouncing off each other, and there was a respect between the two teams that each made a huge contribution to the schools in Kirklees. And the schools in Kirklees themselves accepted that they were well ahead of a lot of schools elsewhere in the country at a time of difficulty in education because of the starting up of tests. You know, tests started in 1991, the first trials, and 92 on a rolling out program. So the 90s were fraught with this new measurement system in schools. So I loved that time because you were part of something, but then you still had your own individuality. So I was the assessment advisor. So I did a huge amount of work and had a huge amount of autonomy on my own for managing my work of going into schools, supporting them in assessment, running courses on assessment, conferences on assessment, producing publication, you know, all that sort of thing you're expected to do. The years and years and years as the big writing person, I suppose, had a loneliness about it because a lot of the time you were on your own on the road and it was you and you met wonderful people and you had lovely days, but you spent long hours travelling and staying in hotels. And it was only if we were organising the event, then Kirsty or one of the other front of houses would go with me. But if I was going to do it for a local authority or another country or another school, they did the organisation and it wasn't necessary, you know, so you were on your own a lot. And then there were other jobs when I was in leadership. I was primary strategy manager in, I won't say where, in West Yorkshire. And that was a lonely time because the authority was in crisis and it was competitive and it was not a nice atmosphere. And all the strategy consultants were about 12 years old. Couldn't resist. Sorry, Emma.
I remember going to schools at 26 advising head teachers thinking, oh my gosh.
I had two wonderful teams, the numeracy and the literacy team that I worked with, and I loved that side of it, but I didn't love the higher management spheres of it.
Yeah, I know what you mean. They were, and I remember everything that I read early on in my career at that time as well had Kirklees on it. Absolutely everything that we ever used.
Yeah, yeah. It was.
Everything. All roads lead to Rome. No, all roads in the 90s in education led back to Kirklees.
Yeah, and I learned so much there, and we all did, and because we used to share. You know, I remember working, there's about 25 in the advisor's office, and we'd all be working away really hard. And then someone would look up suddenly and say, does anyone know anything about? And everyone would sit back and there would be this free flowing. And we all only had little bits of knowledge. But by the time we'd finished, we'd all got a vast picture and we were committing to go off and find out more. You know, it was that culture that moved us forward so much. But can I finish the roles? I think the best and most wonderful was that wonderful time in the desert doing the start-up in Qatar of a huge independent school that my dear professional friend Mick Farley had got the principal role for the whole primary through secondary. But we opened the primary first and I went out to do the start-up management of the first years of the primary school while Mick continued to build on for the secondary and to get the buildings built, because we had to open the first school in blocks of flats because we didn't actually have a school. It was a wonderful time because Mick and I think exactly alike about children, and we could shut ourselves in the office and kick the walls a little bit and sail back out with a smile on our faces.
That's another bit for your headship book. The
most important skill is learning to kick a wall without putting your foot through it. You know, so.
Well, the times Claire and I would answer the door to the office and somebody would say something, we'd go, yeah, just leave it with us. Yeah, leave it with us. Then turn around to each other and just go, ah! either how do we deal with this, or oh my God, I can't believe that just happened. Anyway, we're going to have to wrap this up, Roz, but I'm really pleased we ended on talking about feeling part of a team and feeling like you belong to something, because this is what this new book does. It gives that welcome into the profession, into that kind of collegiate community that we have as teachers for all of our early career colleagues. And I just want to say thank you as well for sharing your knowledge and your expertise and your own journey through education today. It's been absolutely fascinating, and I would highly recommend your book, It's Just a Journey, for anybody to read about education. It's hilarious, it's warm, it's joyful, it's just brilliant. And then the It Takes 5 Years to Become a Teacher, the warmest, most useful book in education you will find for your early career teacher. So thank you so much for joining us, Roz. It's been a treat.
Thank you, Emma. I love working with you. You're a brilliant hostess. Thank you so much, dear.
Thank you so much, darling. Thank you.
Bye. Bye, everyone.
Miller's Netter, just talking to teachers.
Talking to teachers about academic research and evidence-based practice with continuing professional development at PNA 1977 on Twitter.
Miller's Netter, just talking to teachers.